first of, they are doing themselves every single time.
Projection every single time.
Muhammad Azhar replied, where there is suffering, there must be voices raised in solidarity and action. Every person, every story matters. Our hearts are with the Palestinian women and all who endure injustice. A Karim H. posted a screenshot of an article published by Forward, which is a Jewish digital media platform, and the article is entitled, Israeli Army Rabbi Once Justified Rape of Non-Jewish Women. Mm-hmm. Hit above the screenshot. With the blessings of Army Chief Rabbi. And next for today is by Rawa Aouji, mm-hmm. who commented on the horrific test, saying, good morning world, Israel inside the Shifa Hospital and rape. The Israeli army then killed fighters inside the hospital. Now you know, keep doing nothing to stop the genocide.
That's basically horrific. I don't know what to say about it. Basically, it's showing us what the world is made of and what the people of the world are actually made of, because the world and its mainstream media machine just shut down in real time, shut down when all of this was happening, but social media was there up and running and telling the truth. But to be honest, I'm afraid, because I don't know how much more time we have with this small window of opportunity to voice our support and voice the facts, just tell what the story of what's going on, it's the horrific Palestinian narrative of the horrific genocide against them. Anyways, I want to thank you very much, Seema, for your for showing us what social media said and for showing the world what the responsibility for each and every one of us is during these very hard times, especially as users of social media. Thank you very much, Seema, for your time and contribution to your show, to our show. Now, please do stay with us, because we will continue with Figures Exposé. Another topic that swept through traditional media and social media last week was the heinous and cowardly attack at the Crocus City Hall in Moscow. At least 133 people were killed and more than 100 injured after terrorist gunmen opened fire on concert goers and set fire to the venue in one of the deadliest attacks in Russia in decades. This attack brought about many questions, one of which is about the role of the United States of America in this act of terrorism. This prompted YouGov to conduct a poll asking Americans about the possibility of another world war, the role that other countries might play, the roles they themselves might play, and how the United States of America should respond to hypothetical nuclear attacks abroad and at home. Now, when asked if there will be another world war in the next 5 to 10 years, 22% of Americans think that it's very likely that there will be another world war within the next 5 to 10 years. 39% say it is somewhat likely, 18% not sure, 70% not very likely, and 5% not at all likely. Now, 32% of Republicans think it's very likely that there will be another world war in the next decade, 20% of independents, and 16% of Democrats agree. When asked if another world war were to break out, will the United States of America be involved? 77% of Americans believe the United States of America would be involved. Just 6% say the U.S. would not be involved, and the remaining 18% are just unsure. When asked if another world war were to break out, will Russia be involved? 72% believe Russia would be involved and would be on a different side than America. A similar percentage, with 69%, say the same about China. The countries that Americans are most likely to say would be involved in a hypothetical global conflict and on the same side as the United States of America are the United Kingdom with 67%, Ukraine with 58%, and Zionist Israel with 58%. Now let us move on to the most notable exposé voices for this week. On Voices this week, social media users flocked the internet to oppose all forms of terrorism and to strongly condemn the Crocus City Hall terrorist attack. Here's our first voice with Rumium on TikTok, who posted a video with a caption, "Terrorism has no religion." Here's Rumium.
Terrorist attack happened in Russia. Four men with AK-47s entered a shopping mall and opened the fire. They killed 50 to 60 people and set the whole building on fire, which resulted to the death of another 80 to 90 people. After that, they managed to escape. These animals were heading towards the Ukrainian borders, but they were caught and arrested by Russian special forces. After some interrogations, they told Russian police that they will offer $10,000 to do this attack. The saddest part of the story is that nobody knows who are the organizer of this attack, because they told Russian police they will communicate them with the organizers through the Telegram. Was it Ukraine? Was it ISIS? Was it somebody else that we don't know about? Only God knows. American embassy informed their citizens in Russia about upcoming threat 48 hours before the attack. How did they know? God knows. Why they didn't inform Russian special forces? God knows.
With that, ladies and gents, we conclude our expose for tonight. Stay tuned for more eye-opening investigations on Expose. The truth is just a revelation away.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady. You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio, old ladies from all around the world. Welcome back to your own program, Muslim Lady. This is Asma. I have the honor to be your host once again. Yes, welcome to your own program. As usual, we're going to talk about the issues that are related to all the women out there. And in today's episode, we have Sister Nahid with us to help us with the topics. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome.
Assalamu alaikum to you and all your dear listeners. I'm so glad and pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you very much for being here. How are you doing?
Good. Everything is going okay.
So that's perfect. Previously on Muslim Lady, we talked about the factors and important items that are very much crucial for every girl. And right now, I guess there are some more of these factors that we can talk about. As the holy month of Ramadan is just finished, we come to this point to look at the role of women in a much clearer vision. Like right now, we're going to see the changes that Muslim ladies are going to create at their houses or even in the society, not only in the month of Ramadan, but also in the months such as Muharram even. We could see all of these changes that happen through the roles of women, through what women do. So, this is just to draw your attention to the role of women in these holy months and how much of change they bring into the lives of people around them. Like their schedule, the way they're doing things, everything is going to change during the holy month of Ramadan. Now, it's true that mothers are always the center of, they're the engine of the house, but then in the holy month of Ramadan, everything becomes so much more highlighted, so much more exaggerated. Like they spend too much of hours at the kitchen doing a lot of stuff, going through too much of troubles, let's say, because they have to handle a lot of things at the same time. And then you could understand that concept of the engine of the house.
Whenever I think of this, whenever I see my mom just handling a lot of things at home, I just, I feel a power in her, a special power that is just like given to her in a very imaginative way from God. You know, I feel like Allah himself gives this power to all women in this holy month. And it's like they're empowered to act differently, to live differently. Waking up at like 3, preparing food, bringing, I don't know, food for the children, waking the others up. even wash the dishes at that time.
Oh, yeah.
And like, even this sleeplessness is not affecting our mothers. It's not affecting women. There are too many things that can be mentioned over this. Like that devotion that we see in mothers in this special time.
And commitment, of
course. Yeah, exactly. They are defined by these words all the time. But it's like so much shining in the holy month.
Exactly.
Like that devotion that we can see in them, the way they are just acting, the way they are working, those hardships that they are tolerating.
And they work as this driving force for the other member of the family.
Yes.
Like when I see my mother and how hard she's going through too much of difficulties and how hard she's working for the blissful moment of her family, I feel like, okay, I'm younger than her, but I do not have as much energy as she's got.
It's like they're equipped for these kinds of problems.
And I guess that's about being a mother. As if when a girl becomes a mother, she becomes a Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
She could do everything for the happiness of her children and her family, of course.
Yeah.
So this is just the introduction. We would dig a little bit deeper, but after the break. So stay with us. Aside from being the one who provides all the happiness in the house for her family, there's a lot to a mother's role. Like, they are being the role models for their children, and specifically for the girls, for their daughters.
Yeah, you know, when girls just look at their mothers, when daughters look at the mother who is just who is managing everything, you know? Yeah, you mentioned a very pretty point that they are not just cooking and just doing the household chores.
Exactly.
They are at the same time managing the whole life, both spiritually, like emotionally, and they are being the most supportive person in the world at that time.
Yeah.
And the signs that we are observing, the things that the girls, we as girls, as daughters, we are observing in our mothers as just like a role model that we can't be that person right now, you know?
Exactly.
Even if we kill ourselves, we're never going to be that much devoted.
Yeah.
Like, we cannot have that much resilience in facing problems while our parents are, even fathers, you know? But it is highlighted in women, you know?
Yeah.
Like, because
it has been bestowed upon them.
Yeah.
I guess this is a blessing which has been given to them.
Like, the situations that we can see that mothers are just preparing food for food donation. It's like they're going beyond.
Exactly.
They're not only working for their own home. They are preparing things for iftar. They are preparing even iftar for guests. They invited other people to their houses. At the same time, we have a lot of food donation. A very beautiful picture.
And the painter is your mother.
Yeah, exactly. It's a dream world. And the main actor of that picture, the main person is mother.
Exactly.
Like everything is being beautiful with her, with her presence.
So you mentioned it pretty beautifully, like the process of donation, that process that the mothers go through cooking foods for the other people, whether it be for guests or they just spread food to the poor people. Like she's doing this, and by doing this, she actually is teaching her children how to be and how to treat other people, not just being so much engaged with your own personal issues. Try to think about the community, trying to think about your
community.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like the atmosphere of this month somehow changes even in the community, in the society, by the presence of mothers.
Exactly.
Like they are having their impact both on their own family and on the community at the same time.
Exactly. And they're teaching their daughters how to be in the immediate future, of course.
Yeah.
And I'm just telling you that as girls, everything that we remember is either from our mother or from our father. But the things that we learn from our mothers are different. Like just as you said, there are some pictures that we have in our mind, and the painted behind these pictures are just our mothers. Like, the things we learn out there are the things that come directly from mothers. If I want to just bring up a personal experience, I would say that I remember that when I was a child, a little girl actually, at the age of 5 or 6 or somehow, I remember that I was so sleepless. And then I was just sitting beside my mom, and she used to take me to the holy shrine. Now, just imagine, as a child, I was so tired, but I tried to just imitate like whatever she's doing. I was tired and I was so sleepy, but looking at her, she gave me that energy to stay awake with her. Now, see, such a thing for a child is very difficult, but only a mother could teach you such a thing.
Without literally teaching you,
exactly.
Know? They're just like practically transferring them.
Yeah, you're looking at her and she becomes the mirror that would reflect you in herself. Everything about praying, about worship, about caring about other people, and these donations just come directly from our mothers. So we owe them big, I guess.
Yeah, you know, the signs and the things that we can learn from our mothers in this holy month are just like countless. Exactly. We can name the sacrifice we can learn from them, the way they are sacrificing themselves, their wealth, everything. Like, they are teaching us how to forget about ourselves sometimes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes try to look wider, look at the outside circle, look at the community, look at the society.
So let's go for a short break and then we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back. You're listening to Muslim Lady, and in here we're talking about the role of mothers, and there's a lot to their role and whatever they're doing to us, whatever they're teaching us. But then we're talking about the parts that are so much highlighted out there, and there's no one to deny them, of course. So we're talking about the outline point as much as the time is letting us. So, speaking of the role of mothers, I would say that when you go in a lot of ceremonies that are held out there, and then, you know, these families go out, sometimes they go to the holy shrine, they listen to different lectures, and then they take out their children with themselves. Like, I think back in time, I used to say that why they bring their children with themselves, they're so noisy. But then I figured out that what the mothers do by bringing their children to such occasions is to actually teach them.
Yeah, it's like a classroom for children.
Yeah.
They are learning without officially learning. They're looking at their role models and looking at these situations from the outside, like being a child. Like, I totally remember myself in these kinds of iftar sessions. When we were there, I was just like getting confused and at the same time thinking about the situation.
And that's learning things.
Yeah, exactly. That unity of seeing all people next to each other, saying prayers, and just ending their day with being with each other and being so kind and nice to each other was making me think of life this way, as I haven't seen this before. Like, before Ramadan, we do have some sessions like saying prayers and these stuff and lectures, but it wasn't like this much united. It's like everything gets too much clear for us.
Yeah. So I think it's the mothers who are going to teach us, like, to have this run in our blood. Like, when we get older, when we grow older as mothers, or as the ones who are going to spread this to the other generations, we come to recognize that unconsciously and subconsciously, we have learned all these stuff from our mothers. Like, she was the one who took me to these lectures, so I'm going to take my daughters into these lectures as well. Like, she was having a lot of food donations, so I'm going to have a lot of food donation. Like, you get what I say? It's just like a thing, a teacher, a kind teacher that is teaching me everything unconsciously.
Yeah, and it's also like the inheritance, you know? they are inheriting.
Yeah, it becomes your heritage, actually, by time.
Yeah, exactly. And that is, I really love this circle, you know? I really feel proud of myself for living in the community, living in the living this religion that is leading me towards having a circle of friendship, a circle of nice things going around to the next generation and to the next.
Yeah, so that's actually nice. Even thinking about it makes you have a lot of motivation and driving force to go further. So yes, we have to thank all the mothers out there, all the kind engines of the families who make everything go so smoothly. They tire themselves out for everyone not to feel any hardship during this month. So thank you. Thank you for your existence, and thank you for all the beautiful things that you have taught us, all the mothers, all the Muslim ladies out there. Thank you for you being here. So this was all the time that we had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something. Something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی است.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
نزل القرآن يهدي للتي أقوم ويبشر المؤمنين.
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت القرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
كتاب الله.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality. Back to
it's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Factoriality. Well, this is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be your host in today's episode. And, of course, like always, we have two very dear guests. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Muzaffar, and assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And as the ritual of this program goes, I would like you to introduce yourself briefly.
First of all, assalamu alaikum to you and all your dear listeners. Well, I'm Nahid. I'm a graduate of TFO, and I've been studying and researching on Muslim issues, and especially Muslim women issues. And I'm so glad and honored to be here with you.
Yeah, so good. And you, brother?
I am Muzaffar Haider from the UK. I've been studying in the Hawza for the past 10 years in the holy city of Qom. And here I am today with you lovely people.
Thank you very much. I wish both of you luck and success. As always, we in here in Back to Reality, we come to bring up some topics and then to see what are the ideas, what are different perspectives on different topics. As for today, I am going to put it this way. Do you think happiness is the purpose of life?
Happiness is the purpose of life. Yes, it is.
Yeah, thank you. So to those who say yes and to those who say no, if happiness is not the purpose of life, then what is the purpose of life?
Exactly. That's my point. Exactly. If it's not happiness, what is it?
Yeah.
You know, there are, what I think is that there are many perspectives on life. And when it comes to happiness, we should first define happiness. Like, happiness is one sudden feeling in us human beings that makes us so excited about achieving the goal. What I mean is that without a goal, we won't be happy. Mm-hmm. So happiness is not the process. Happiness is the destination. We work hard. We try. During this process, we not necessarily are happy. But when we achieve our goal, at that very moment we feel happy.
It's only a momentary thing, is what
yes.
you think.
Okay, and you, if happiness is the only purpose of life?
Well, the thing is, the way that Sister Nahid has defined it is a very temporary thing, and in that sense I can agree with it. That would not be the purpose of life, because it's only a short-lived thing. However, the happiness that I'm talking about is true happiness, inner peace kind of happiness, which should be one of the goals of life. And even if we do say that it's only a temporary feeling, then, you know, that catharsis should be something that we strive for.
Yeah.
Okay,
what you mean is
but
that the satisfaction within ourselves, like we are satisfied with the situation that we are working for?
Yeah, because without that peace, you're not going to acquire what we would refer to as happiness, right?
Are we able to achieve that happiness?
I would argue that yes, you are. Okay, so the happiness that I'm talking about is slightly different to the way that the Western world, or perhaps even the modern world, would define it. There's a hadith of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and he says that the fruits of the intellect is a surur, this happiness. You're going to get joyful through the intellect. So there are four faculties within mysticism in Islam. You know, the whole akhlaq, the great akhlaq masters like Allama Tabatabai, Ayatollah Bahjat, Imam Khomeini, all of these greats, they always speak about four human faculties. One is the aql, the intellect, which is supposed to be the guiding kind of spiritual force within you. It's always pointing towards God. One of them is the imagination, another is anger, another is passion, desire. Now, a human being is supposed to have all of these things, right? Even passion, you might think that desire is an evil thing because it draws us towards our lower animalistic self. But without that, you're not going to enjoy your food. Can you imagine life where you're not actually enjoying eating your iftar after fasting? The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, there are two joys for a fasting person. The first is when he opens his iftar, you know, that first bite of food. And the second is when he meets his Lord. These are all about happiness, that joy of existence itself. Coming back to the four faculties, Why is this significant? Because I've asked numerous people from my friends and relatives which faculty does happiness actually belong to? And they all said the desire, the shahwa, the passion. Meaning that the Western world has pretty much defined happiness as being something that you acquire through eating, drinking, and through fulfilling the other
physical materialistic senses, right? Things.
But that is not happiness.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing a talk somewhere, and he was talking about how happiness is separate from pleasure. Pleasure is one thing.
Yeah.
Happiness is another thing.
Yeah, in that case...
But does that make sense? I mean, it's not the way that we're defining happiness.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, in that case, I can just refer to that thing that I mentioned, that people are defining happiness in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, a lot of people believe in happiness in a way that we just feel happy of achieving something or fulfilling our needs. But even going back to our own purpose in life, like even if we want to consider the other schools of life, Islam, I don't know, the other schools at the same time, in many acceptable logical schools, we are asked to work for self-improvement and self-growth.
Mm.
Even through achieving those goals, we need to be satisfied with ourselves. We need to be happy with the thing that we are working for. That is a kind of satisfaction within us that, it can lead to that meaning of happiness, which is sometimes the opposite side of what is shown to us, what is kind of dictated to us.
Mm-hmm.
So we go for the break, and then after that, we'd follow what we were talking about. Welcome back. Well, you're listening to Back to Reality. Brother Mozaffa and Sister Nahid are helping us with the topic of happiness. Okay, so far we've talked about these two very important issues, that there is a difference between pleasure and happiness. Pleasure goes for all the materialistic and physical stuff, and then happiness is something deeper. It could be equal to the peace, inner peace that you might feel, or satisfaction. And then also you mentioned the fact that the process of achieving something is going to lead to happiness.
Yeah.
Now the question is, haven't you ever been in this situation where you pursue something so passionately, so hard you try for it, but the moment you achieve it, you feel like you're not satisfied?
Yeah, for sure. In a lot of situations, you achieve something that you just made it so big, you exaggerated it in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
But the moment you achieve it, you realize that it's not worth working that much. Yeah, we feel this. But what I am thinking of right now is connecting the things that our brother mentioned to my own belief that when we enjoy the process, when we know what we are working for, when we know what feeling we are having within ourselves, even if we achieve that goal and we don't feel that much happy, we still can be proud of ourselves for tolerating all the tough situations, all the hardships throughout our way.
Yes, you're proud of yourself, but you're not happy.
Yeah, it may happen. You're not happy with that definition that you need to be just so glad of achieving something, but you are satisfied of your process.
See, when I say happy, I exactly mean the satisfaction that you must get from whatever you have done. Like, it's not to persuade yourself that I'm happy for whatever I did. No, it must be something that comes intuitively. So naturally, I don't know if I'm making my point or not.
No, it's very interesting, sister, because different people will define happiness in different ways.
Yeah.
For you, happiness is defined as a feeling of satisfaction after a struggle.
Not necessarily a struggle.
I thought that's what you said.
Not necessarily a struggle in whatever you do.
It's an achievement. Okay, satisfaction in that achievement.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
But then you can't achieve something. The Holy Quran, you know, states, "Inna ma'al usri yusra." Surely with difficulty is ease. And part of the philosophy behind that is that if you want to achieve something, you've got to struggle before it, right?
Of course.
It's gonna, you know, if you go to the gym, you're going to work out, and then, you know, you get bigger or, you know, more fit because you've gone through the struggle. So that is something that will give happiness. There's this bodybuilder.
But then, there's also another verse that says, "Inna al-insana lafi khusr."
Surely human beings are in loss, completely lost.
So then I guess there is no such a thing as happiness to be the purpose of life.
It is very important. However, you know, it's not the purpose. If you're striving your entire life to acquire happiness, chances are you're not going to get it.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Maybe among the people who are listening to us, there are those who are in a younger age, and then they feel like there comes a moment in which they're going to feel this complete happiness.
Yeah.
But then this is an illusion.
You know, have you ever met somebody who's happy all the time?
They are faking that
happiness.
Thank you.
It's really irritating, isn't it?
Yeah, of course.
But why are you happy? It's not a happy day.
Exactly.
You know, be sad sometimes. And this is the natural balance that a lot of human beings need to learn. Mm-hmm. I need to learn myself. Where you need to be happy some days, you need to be sad some days. It's okay.
Yeah, that's
the Holy Quran states, وَأَنَّهُ هُوَ أَضْحَكَ وَأَبَكَ. It's He, Allah, who causes people to laugh and cry. Now, we have to recognize that this journey through life, where, you know, through which Allah is essentially creating us, is a journey of ups and downs, and we've got to learn to be satisfied with those ups and downs.
Exactly. And then we have, just as we talk about happiness, since we human beings understand things based on binary oppositions, then comes the concept of difficulties. So when we're talking about happiness and the fact that happiness, in the sense of the worldly, in the worldly sense, could not be achieved as in an everlasting feeling and emotion, we're not going to achieve it, of course. But then comes the concept of difficulty.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
The purpose of life is not happiness, and there are a lot of difficulties in the way. Why?
You know, again, we need to talk about our goals, our purpose. If happiness is not our purpose, then we surely need to
not
have some goals.
Not that it's not our purpose, you know? It's not that consciously I want happiness and I cannot achieve it. It is not the nature of life to give you that happiness that you have in your mind.
Yeah. Life is designed for us to, in a way that we are going
it's
to face
a test.
Difficulties.
It's an ongoing test. So if for a moment you think you're happy and everything is going to last like this forever, then you're dead wrong.
You know, if you're talking about the difficulties and the hardships that we're going to face, what I always think of this, how I always think of this is in a way that I try to practice with the things that I believe in, you know? Mm-hmm. For example, I'm working hard for something. I don't know, I'm studying hard for a test, and I'm having a really tough time. I'm having a lot of challenges talking to my family over, like, leaving me alone, giving me some freedom, some time to study, some privacy. And at the same time, I'm having much a struggle with my own students at work as a teacher. And
the list is ongoing.
Exactly. And still, I need to manage my own goal, manage my own desire, and manage my studies over that exam.
And inner conflict, of course, add to that a lot of more side notes.
If as a mature person, I consider all the perspectives over this goal, I know it's hard. We are human beings. We feel shocked whenever we face a challenge or we face a hard situation. But if we look at it in a mature way, we still believe that although it is hard, I'm working for something bigger. So that's why I'm tolerating this. This is what is also recommended to us throughout our religion in Islam. We are recommended to tolerate for the bigger goal.
The purpose of life, of course, is not happiness, and at the same time, it's not to go through too much of difficulties. There must be a balance between all of these paradoxical feelings. And as human beings, I guess we learn that throughout the journey of our life. So thank you, Brother Muzaffar, and thank you, Sister Nahid.
My pleasure.
And thank you, dear listeners. I hope you had an enjoyable moment with us. A happy moment. Even if it is temporarily. But then, This was all the time that we had for today's episode. Hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabbal Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabbal Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Citizens under surveillance.
To watch without being seen, that's the spirit of surveillance. It's always present in the citizens' lives. But in the past 10 years, along with the pace of technological advances, we have witnessed a revolution. Targeted surveillance has gradually turned into mass surveillance worldwide. In the past, it only focused on public areas, but now it's violating our privacy. Closing the door or drawing the curtains at home is not enough anymore. The invisible eye is settled in our privacy. Online items and games, activities on social networks, local details of our smartphones, and inquiries on the search engines. Our online life turns into data. The information that, when processed, makes a new form of identity on which we have no control. Our private life could be laid bare in a matter of moments. This is what we will watch in this preventive film. A few minutes would be enough for hackers to tap into all this information. This experience is a warning. Our online life doesn't belong to us. Never have we been scrutinized so much. 70% of our calls by mobile phones are recorded. Millions of hours of discussion by webcam are diverted by the secret services. Our existence is now accessible on the internet in the form of databases, and every single detail of our lives is retained in the memories by the storage centers. Who records this valuable information? How is it exploited, and for what purposes? We have conducted a survey for 2 years in Europe and in the United States. We went to meet the experts in digital surveillance, hackers and whistleblowers, and also the web giants such as Google or Facebook, and also the secret services that process and collect our data. As the boundaries between surveillance, technology and power fade, we will see that the gap is growing between two groups. On one side, defenders of individual freedoms, and on the other, supporters of cyber surveillance. A paradigm shift that can lead the citizens towards a new social model. Mark Rotenberg is an internationally renowned jurist. He has been heard many times by the Congress and the US Senate for his expertise in the field of the internet. He is the head of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, one of the main associations for the protection of privacy.
I think, you know, our modern societies are facing a choice about the future, and I think it's fundamentally a political choice. I think we could decide through an action to say, well, you know, we don't care very much about this. We don't care very much if the government gathers up all this information. We don't care very much about who has access to it, how it's used. We don't care if our children grow up in such a world of constant surveillance. And I think that could happen. I mean, I think there are some people who have this view. You know, it's our modern life. We'll just all get used to it. I hope it doesn't happen. You see, I hope it doesn't happen because I think such a future will be a digital prison. We will have the experience that people have when they're in a prison.
We abandon a part of our freedoms by accepting to be monitored in our private lives. In the field of surveillance, two viewpoints are nowadays coexisting and competing in the world. Some are rebelling against these violations of privacy in the name of individual freedom, while others consider technological developments as a preferred means of strengthening the security level. The United States, where the public domain may be monitored without any legal authorization, has developed an initiative for the pioneer collective surveillance, the NOLA Project. Citizens are at the heart of this community video surveillance project.
I can watch all 32 cameras at any time from any computer or iPhone. I was really excited when I found out that my crime cameras were linked directly to the cops. It's a new issue that the cops are getting help from private citizens, and I think in New Orleans it's important for the private citizens to become a part of crime fighting. Our police force is tasked. It's declining. We have certain issues that we don't have enough police force and enough eyes on the street.
The hyper-connectivity has enabled a former police officer, Brian Lagarde, to set up a private monitoring system with an unlimited development capacity. All the images captured by the citizens' cameras come together in this management center.
Project NOLA is greatly assisting the local police department because we're bringing citizens together. We're using modern technology, cutting-edge technology, and we're putting all this together where the citizens and the police, they're all combined together. Each one of these cameras, they're hosted on someone's home or on somebody's business. They're not on telephone poles. They're not on public property. And each one of these people are volunteering to host a camera, allow it to connect to their internet connection, where it then flows through into this building where we're able to record it free of charge.
In Europe, it is officially forbidden to film your neighbor's garden. But here in America, not only is this possible, the images may be broadcast on the internet.
Two of us, the two neighbors, we got together and arranged the cameras to point in two directions so that anyone going either direction on the street, we would get a shot of their face. So what you'll notice, this one's this way, and the other camera in my neighbor's house is pointed in this direction. And these are 3-megapixel night vision cameras. They're lit up by IR lights. So at night, you can see a little bit of a red glow to them, and they work quite well. These are recorded inside the home, in my case, and Project NOLA, through the internet, has access to both of these cameras.
We can send the video to the responding detectives and police officers instantly. Two people robbed a lady, they beat her up, they took her purse. And what helped the police so much is A, we're able to identify the perpetrators, and B, we have the perpetrator with the lady's purse, and then this perpetrator was actually smiling as he was running. So when he goes to court, he's going to have a very bad time in front of that judge because he was smiling. Of course, they're not going to like that very much. Each one of these cameras, all these 770 cameras that I have around me right now, they can all be used in a court of law for when the bad things happen.
It's into this morning, and somewhere in here, I go off to work. There's probably an image of us standing outside the house. You'd be able to get their face. I think we're giving up a little bit of liberty, but we gain a lot in security. So it's a balance, and I think we found a pretty happy balance. And here's sort of the big point. We're winning.
The word security is increasingly associated with surveillance. We went to meet one of the world's leading researchers in this field. Sociologist David Lyon, a professor at the University of Kingston, leads the research laboratory of surveillance, where he has studied for 20 years the impacts of surveillance on our lifestyles.
There are questions about some balance or some tension between liberty on the one hand and privacy on the other, or security and liberty. There are various ways in which this debate is located. However, it seems to me that, again, the big questions still need to be asked. The word security is one of the most influential words in the world today, and it is also the least carefully defined. The definition of what is security leaves many, many questions, particularly as the word is frequently associated with national security. What is national security? Whose national security are we trying to protect or maintain? So questions like this, I think, are tremendously important ones.
Now we're going to meet those who think that security does not justify the renunciation of our fundamental freedoms. German engineer Carsten Knoll is an expert in technology. He gives us an appointment in Berlin, the Security Research Lab, his research laboratory on computer security. His company has gained international reputation by exposing the failures of mobile network carriers. He himself has broken the security code of the SIM cards that equip all our phones in order to reveal their failures. Now, if they want to reinforce the security of computer networks, they come straight to him. The science doctor knows very well how you can use these new technologies to encroach on anyone's privacy. And it was to protect our privacy that on September 5, 2001, only a few days before the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the European Union was going to adopt the historical sanctions against the United States in order to make it cease the large-scale spying on phone calls and fax messages, and especially to make it give up the establishment of email surveillance. Europe knew that since the Second World War, the NSA, along with the intelligence services of its Anglo-Saxon allies, monitored the old continent under a program called Echelon. But a week later, on September 11th, 2001, the attacks on America brushed aside this European initiative altogether. In a single day, the scope of the security measures around the world changed entirely. The U.S. president at the time, George W. Bush, signed the Patriot Act, the anti-terrorism law, which established the most ambitious surveillance project in history with the support of Europe.
This new law that I signed today will allow surveillance of all communications used by terrorists, including emails, the internet, and cell phones. As of today, we'll be able to better meet the technological challenges posed by this proliferation of communications technology.
The idea of terrorism was distilled into a particular understanding of terrorism, which, of course, in practice, was frequently associated with particular groups. And so that designation came to capture what terrorism was supposedly all about. One of the problems with that is that the ways that surveillance were developed after 9/11 was to use the same kind of cover-all description, terrorism, terrorist, to begin to include other groups as well.
At the heart of the surveillance system post September 11, a man enjoyed all the attention of the U.S. president on security policy. Now a partner in an influential law firm, Stuart Baker was then the NSA's general counsel and deputy secretary in charge of internal security in the Bush administration. He is one of the implementers of U.S. security ambitions.
I don't think there's any effort or reasonable likelihood that the entire population of the United States could be controlled on pretty much anything. But in many cases, you do have to look at all of the information about the entire population in order to find people who are trying very hard to escape your notice, to try to hide from you. And often it is only when you look at the entire population that the people who are the riskiest, you don't know that they're guilty of anything, but you know that they are riskier than others, can get the attention that they deserve.
Security takes center stage in the U.S. government's policy priorities. From 2001 to 2013, the total intelligence budget gets doubled to reach 40 billion euros. A quarter of it is reserved for the NSA, the eyes and ears of the secret services. The agency's Maryland headquarters are off limits to investigative journalists. The NSA has provided us with official images worthy of a low-grade TV series where the same comedians appear in each plan to give us an idea of the work of 15,000 agents of the site. What is behind this pretense, behind which they can monitor the life of anyone, anywhere in the world? Of those who know about the agency's secret operations, only a few people have broken their silence. In a forest near the headquarters of the NSA, we meet Thomas Drake, a former Navy officer hired by the agency in 2001 to be in charge of the surveillance operations. A few months later, irritated by the processes, he opposes the hierarchy, putting his life in danger.
I confronted my immediate supervisor, the number three person at NSA. I said, "We're engaging in surveillance of Americans on an extraordinarily broad scale without a warrant." And he said, "You don't understand. Everything's different now." The phrase that was used was, "We live in exigent conditions." That means extraordinary means are necessary to deal with a threat. And he said, we just need the data. And then he said, "Don't ask any more questions. You don't want to go there." It was more than just a passing threat to me.
After these revelations, Thomas Drake was accused of high treason in 2006. He faced the risk of being sentenced to life imprisonment. After 5 years of proceedings, the charges were dismissed in the absence of evidence.
In 2006, I came under direct investigation by the U.S. government. Why? Because I was disclosing crimes being committed by the U.S. government against its own people in total violation of the Fourth Amendment. All done in secret because the executive decided, you know what? We don't have to have an open and free democracy. We don't need transparency. We will determine in secret what's best for the American people, and we will keep them safe on our terms.
A surveillance state, by definition, means that anything that it surveils is suspicious. Whether or not you're doing anything suspicious doesn't matter. By definition, you're subject to surveillance, which means you're automatically suspicious. And that's the real danger, that everybody is assumed to be suspicious until proven otherwise. It completely flips, even in the United States, what our system of justice is. But you just remember, all this is happening largely in secret, and they're not going to yield willingly. I mean, you've seen the power elite, okay, those who are in charge, they're not going to give this up lightly. It's a seductive thing to have all this knowledge available, all this data available, just literally at the tips of your fingers. In this case, at a click of a mouse.
In Montreal, Ubisoft has done cyber surveillance over the engine of a video game, Watch Dogs. In this game, smartphones are replaced with firearms. It took 5 years of investigation and hard work for more than 400 developers to create Watch Dogs, a venture far less futuristic than it seemed.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers, sisters, listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program Mafatih al-Hayat, Keys of Life. One of the keys of life that we have been looking at is supporting our brothers mentally, morally, spiritually. We also spoke about financially. One of the things that we have to support our brothers in terms of morally and ethically is to come to their aid. As we use the term in Arabic, Ighathatul Muslim, to help the Muslim in need. And mind you, when, and Islamically speaking, when we talk about